I think almost from the moment we got acquired by Red Hat, there is kind of like a not an if but when to at least go work at a startup again. So we actually had a bunch of different ideas at the beginning. Zanzibar was just kind of one of them, but it was the one that we kind of had a gut feeling was going to be like the most realistic one that we would go after. Basically, no one cared about us whatsoever until we open sourced. So I think open source is a huge top of funnel for your business. Like, we've had customers that are like, it was a 3-line change. I can't believe it. Like, I cannot believe it.
Makes
It's
sense.
truly
Wow.
magical.
Welcome to the second season of Optimize All the Things podcast. I'm your host, Bartek Płotka.
And I'm your host, Ivan Volkov. Optimize All the Things is a podcast in which we talk about technology, software engineering, careers, soft skills, and really all the things we can optimize in our work and life. And this season, we focus on tech startups.
In today's session, we talk to Jimmy Zielinski, a co-founder of AltZ and maintainer of SpiceDB open source project. We discussed the importance of open source and public tech research ecosystems for building the business. We dive into authorization nuances in modern software architecture, different ways to find customers, and more.
Let's jump straight into the conversation.
Hello, everyone. Today we have Jimmy on our podcast, and I know Jimmy from my ex job from Red Hat. We used to chat a lot about what you did. What was the platform? Geez, that was a very popular container platform. How it's called?
Quay.
Image registry. Quay. Oh my God, so funny stories from kind of SRE stories around that. So I'm really admiring that your work and the fact that you are here. And let's start it. Maybe would you like to introduce yourself with, I don't know, a few words?
Sure. I'm Jimmy Zielinski. I am a co-founder and CPO of a company called AuthZ. That company builds a open source project called SpiceDB. And SpiceDB is basically a database that is optimized for storing and querying the data that you use to determine authorization decisions. And the reason why that exists is because you can actually build really powerful experiences. Basically, around a whole product suite or a set of microservices that have all this data centralized and queryable and testable and understandable kind of in one centralized platform. And then we do a whole bunch of distributed systems to make sure that that system doesn't go down because now it's very critical. But prior to that, I did a whole bunch of distributed systems work kind of at a company called CoreOS, which got acquired by Red Hat. While I was there, I worked on Quay, which is the first private Docker image registry. So before even Docker could have private images, we were storing images there. And then that kind of morphed into work on Tectonic, which was CoreOS's Kubernetes platform. I built kind of operators and ran like the operator framework team there. And then also, when we got acquired by Red Hat, became product manager for OpenShift, which is their Kubernetes platform. Eventually, kind of transitioning back into an SRE role. This whole time, I'm being a product manager. I'm also carrying a pager for the services, still doing engineering work. I really like to be close to technology, and I feel like you can only make the best product decisions for developers if you are like still empathizing with the developers and developing software yourself. So that's like a pretty quick summary of my background.
Your first job was in software engineering. How did you get into software engineering?
Yeah, so I have to thank one of my co-founders who actually really encouraged me to kind of make the transition between the two. I feel like I never fully made the transition because obviously I'm still like writing code and committing stuff and carrying the pager. But I think what I learned about myself personally was that the reason why I liked developing software was to deliver value to end users. So a lot of people really like to write software because it like scratches a technical itch, or they learn a thing, or they get to do something really clever. It's kind of like solving a puzzle. I basically got my motivation from actually having something that someone can use and derive value from. And I think that's like a very natural transition then to product because that's kind of what product focuses on. And I was lucky to be working in a startup at the time. And basically, startups are kind of more malleable with what people's roles are than a big company where there's like a corporate hierarchy. So I was actually able to have more influence and kind of like care about these things kind of extracurricular to what I was doing until it kind of just made more sense for me to be doing it full time. And like, honestly, I also think that when you're working in a startup, like you are keeping track of the ecosystem because you want to know how your company is doing health-wise, or else like you need to know when you need to jump ship, basically. So I think a lot of time people in startups are also paying attention to the general ecosystem and those kind of things. And all of that like just added more context for me to like care more and more about the product itself and how it was positioned rather than necessarily these 10 lines of code that are going into the product.
Makes sense. Was that the CoreOS, that first startup, or?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that was CoreOS. Yeah.
How you got as a I guess inexperienced engineer to such amazing startup?
How did I start working there? Or...
Yeah. Like how did you find, you know, how they found you and you found them?
It's actually kind of funny. The story for CoreOS was I like knew the name a little bit because of etcd. Basically, in college, I took a concurrency like class, basically, that taught you how to use like thread pools in Java. And that kind of really made me upset with how clunky those APIs were. and so I got really into like Erlang, and then Go was like this new pre-1.0 language at the time. So I started to get kind of more involved in the Go ecosystem. And one of the like basically shining projects, the project that like the Go team pointed to that they were like super impressed that made Go like a real production ready language at the time, was a project called Doozer. And Doozer was written by a couple people at Heroku, but it was basically a Paxos implementation. It was a key value store, basically an implementation of Chubby at Google. And that is actually like the spiritual predecessor to etcd, which is obviously the data store we're all familiar with now, powering Kubernetes. But that was built at CoreOS and actually like had some contributions from the people originally like kind of working on Doozer. So I knew about etcd at the time, just from being in the Go ecosystem really early, and knew CoreOS through that. And one day I just, like I had graduated college and I literally just saw, basically they acquired my co-founder's first company. And that started an office for CoreOS in New York City. And I was like, oh, wow, they're like not on the West Coast anymore. That's really cool. And I just sent Pulvi, one of the founders of CoreOS, an email. I was like, hey, I saw that you're doing this like container stuff. I've also been like doing some container stuff because I actually, going further back, I actually worked on a bunch of BitTorrent technology that became part of Tupperware, which is Facebook's internal container orchestration platform. And that was just purely open source work. Be careful what you build in the open source. People will start using it for stuff. But yeah, I just sent him a thing and it was like an email cold entirely being like, hey, I'm doing this kind of interesting BitTorrent stuff with containers. You guys are doing a lot of stuff with containers. Maybe it's a good fit. And that was basically that. He was like, okay, we'll bring you in. Interview, and I think his girlfriend at the time was living in New York, so he's flying back and forth a lot. So he was in the office there, and then I met my future co-founders in an interview, and that was that. I started working at CoreOS. This is kind of late 2014, so yeah. This is before Kubernetes. This is before CNCF. All just kind of Docker.
Okay, so my question is wrong. Like, you were not inexperienced developer at that point. you are super passionate about, you know, open source and already have some, you know, opinions. So that definitely, you know, help enormously. And okay, sounds like you kind of like got even more experience in product building in various roles. And eventually, I guess at Red Hat and you know, at the further, you were thinking about, you know, founding a company. So can you share a little bit, you know, the moment when you decided to become a founder? You know, how it happened?
Yeah, I think almost from the moment we got acquired by Red Hat, there is kind of like a not an if, but when to at least go work at a startup again. I don't want to believe I poisoned the well for myself for like big companies or anything like that. I learned a lot working at Red Hat. I think it's a great place to work. I don't think it was like the right place for me at the time, for like what I wanted to do. And so basically it was kind of just a matter of time. And what ended up happening was Google published this paper kind of documenting their internal system for how they handle authorization. And this is the basis that we used to basically build SpiceDB. We took this paper and decided to basically build an open source implementation of it, but make it like less googly and more like friendly to the whole world. And so we kind of read this paper because we were pretty plugged into basically reading the papers out of Google Research, because that was just prior to the CNCF, that was kind of where these innovations were coming from in cloud software. So you would read these research papers and implement them. So this was just one of the other ones, and that came out. We read it and it kind of clicked for us. We had had all these problems scaling Quay when it comes to authorization and building out Tectonic. And we just saw this as like the actual solution to that problem. Looked around, no one was building it. So at that point in time, kind of we looked at each other and we're like, all right, no one is doing this. And when I started working at CoreOS, they had been freshly acquired, my co-founders, building Quay, the private Docker registry. But it was largely just the three of us for a long time building that product and basically running it and selling it and getting it, basically building a business out of it. So we already had some decent amount of experience kind of just working the three of us to start from scratch and really build something out. So I don't think we lacked the confidence to go out and be like, all right, let's give it another try with everything we learned from CoreOS. So yeah, I think there was really the moment of being acquired and being like, okay, this is probably not for us. We're probably going to do this again in the future. And then the moment where the paper came out, and we're like, okay, this is the one. This is what's worth actually like leaving over.
Was OZ always looking like that? Basically, was your idea always to sell scalable authorization kind of as a service? Or did you have to iterate through some ideas until you get to its current look?
Yeah, I think we definitely didn't land on this immediately. We definitely had a couple of ideas in our back pocket. One of the bits of advice I would give people is when you're starting out, don't be too attached to a particular idea, because you can kind of like, you'll die on that hill, like quite literally the company will die on that hill. Yeah. So you kind of have to be malleable and have like the humility to basically admit you're wrong and change things. So we actually had a bunch of different ideas at the beginning. Zanzibar was just kind of one of them, but it was the one that we kind of had a gut feeling was going to be like the most realistic one that we would go after. Actually, literally another one was continuous profiling, which talked about that, I was like, I bet Frederick's just going to do this. And so I was not wrong with that. No, so we didn't pursue that one. But Frederick, he left maybe like a month after us. So it's quite possible like there could have been a world where we actually just all worked together on that one. So yeah, but that was definitely one of the ideas. But even when we knew that kind of SpiceDB was going to be our thing, how it was going to be our thing was not really clear at first. So we kind of tried a couple different ideas that we built using SpiceDB as our secret sauce. Like internally, it's the thing that's going to enable us to have a competitive advantage in like this domain or this domain. And we got to build a whole bunch of applications using SpiceDB, which is great because then we're dog fooding and developing SpiceDB and understanding it and knowing what it's like to integrate with it. But then ultimately it turned out that basically people just cared about SpiceDB itself. And then we experimented for a while. We had it proprietary for a while, like just as a SaaS. And people really want transparency in security critical software, and especially databases. It's just the norm for a database to be open source because that's handling your data. And you want to basically have the ability to really understand the technology dealing with something so sensitive. So ultimately, then when we open sourced it, that was a big splash, and that like kind of truly locked in the momentum around the project. And we knew like SpiceDB open source, basically doing a standard kind of database playbook, but in this new domain that's basically been ignored by industry for a while, was going to be the business.
I really want to dive kind of deeper into open source and OZ and SpiceDB, but before that, it will be super interesting to hear one of your other ideas and how were you able to kind of quickly identify that it wasn't something that will be big. And I know about like one of them. Maybe we can talk about it or not. Can you tell us more about ShareWit.io? What was that? And how do you figure out that this won't be the next, you know, billion-dollar company?
Yeah, absolutely. ShareWith was basically one of our early prototypes that we used SpiceDB to power. The idea was, okay, maybe SpiceDB is a little bit too low level. Folks maybe don't want to have to write these things. What can we build that is like a higher level abstraction for folks? So we built kind of this platform called ShareWith, which was basically a central platform that let you dynamically create OAuth applications and then kind of set rules and manage those in one place. You can kind of think of it as a competitor to maybe like Teleport or Tailscale, in that you can kind of like set it. It's basically kind of OAuth proxy as a service, but centralized and lets you manage it. And obviously that scratched a niche for us because we had internal infrastructure we wanted to secure too. But this was just kind of like, hey, let's see if people care about this. This is one of the things you can build with SpiceDB. And honestly, it was super useful for us to write, to understand what it was like to integrate with SpiceDB. Like I said, the dog fooding aspect, when you start a company, it's really hard to get your first customer. Like, there's going to be time where you have no customers. So you're going to have to do something in the interim. And in the interim, it makes sense to try to build something with your own technology. So you really got a good understanding of what it was like to build against these APIs and really understand the problem space there. But ultimately, people just didn't care about ShareWith at all. No one really looked at it and was like, huh, this would really solve my problem. Because actually that market of like kind of securing your infrastructure is fairly crowded. And you really have to, like, I feel like ShareWith wasn't ambitious enough. And one of the things with startups is like, you have to be like kind of naive and ambitious. Even more than you think, like if you're very conservative, like you won't have the ambition to actually build something large and make the change that has to happen to justify having like a full business around a thing. And so I think when basically no one started to show up and there was no reason, like no one used it except for us, despite us kind of like showing it to a bunch of people, we kind of knew it wasn't going to have product market fit and then just kind of used it as like a dog fooding experience, which was super cool because we actually wrote everything initially in Python, including that because Quay was written in Python. So we were really, really fast at writing that stuff, but we got to use a lot of the kind of new tools in the Python space. So that was cool because I'm shocked at how fast you can write Python these days. Like, especially if you're experienced, there's like type annotations now. And like, we basically wrote everything to be functional and lazy, loading and streaming. And that is not typically how a lot of people write Python, but it actually was like shockingly fast. Like, eventually we rewrote a bunch of stuff in Go, but like, naive Go versus like expert Python is not actually that far apart. But the difference between expert Go and expert Python is actually a pretty big gap in performance. So you'd be surprised what you can do with some of these like prototyping languages and tools. I definitely would not hesitate to start a new project in Python again.
Oh my God, so many learnings. I mean, just the fact that you built you kind of like refused to build this foundation block first because maybe it's too low level. So you kind of like started building it because you needed it anyway, but you wanted to kind of like sell this application on top of it. And you realize that this foundation is actually the main problem to solve, right? It's like, you know, I would build some application that would need tracing and realize that tracing is a bigger problem to solve. It's kind of like so many learnings and with Python as well. So would you say, Would you start in Python again if you could start again?
I think it depends. I mean, there's always hindsight's 2020, right? Like yeah. If I knew exactly what I was building at the end, I think there's this whole spectrum where I think it's really easy to kind of build something quickly using Python if you don't know what your end goal is going to be or end shape of your software will be.
Learn.
And then you learn in that process. I think Go is actually probably a good middle ground for that too. I think it's actually pretty easy to refactor. We were really lucky just because Go has an ecosystem of other databases written in it. So there's a lot of things that we could reuse and a lot of just things that are very stable in that ecosystem. Like a lot of people ask me, why didn't we write it in Rust? And basically our primary interface is gRPC to try to have as low latency as possible. And just at the time, like Tonic, which is the protobuf kind of libraries in Rust, were just not mature. They basically just barely got created by the time we were kind of working on this stuff. So the gRPC ecosystem really wasn't there in Rust, and just like a lot of the tooling that we were able to just use off the shelf because of the ecosystem wasn't there. We haven't done a lot of work in Rust, but I have heard from lots of other friends that it can be tricky to refactor that stuff. So I don't really recommend that for your very early prototyping phases, because you want a language where you can completely just like rip out whole portions and test ideas very quickly. As that idea kind of like cements and you know that this is what the shape should be long term, I think it makes a lot of sense to do maybe another rewrite and really optimize for your margins of your business.
Makes sense. And let me go back a little bit to this Zanzibar proposal, like research paper. I mean, I can see in your journey, I was kind of following your company, you know, like you were kind of mentioning this so many times. You even built like a tool for viewing and annotating papers, or I guess this paper, to teach people like why this is kind of like brilliant. And actually, I think there's annotation like how this is different to SpiceDB. And I found it like super, super deep and like helpful. And I think it's amazing that you are proud of it. So two questions, like how many papers you read to get to Zanzibar eventually? And second question, like how do you think critical was that to you, to the current success of your of Zed?
Yeah, I think there's kind of a culture. I think it really depends what kind of ecosystem you're in. I'm sure the folks doing like a lot of the cutting edge machine learning research right now too are also like neck deep in papers. I think for a while there was distributed systems were kind of like popping off, at least in like the like 2010s basically, and maybe just like the second half of the 2000s. And I think a lot of that was all kind of being published, thankfully, from these hyperscalers being very like kind about sharing internal details of what they were doing. I mean, the whole Hadoop ecosystem kind of grew out of that. Out of basically Yahoo re-implementing stuff that Google was openly publishing about, right? That's how that ecosystem got started. So it was kind of natural for me also just being a student and like wondering how all these things work to actually start digging in and reading these papers early on. At the time, I have a folder that's like backed up to Google Drive and everything, and it has all white papers in it that I've like studied and read over the years. There's probably a couple hundred in there, but like realistically, when the ones that were critical to this were largely like, I don't know, 20 to 40 of them, mostly in the distributed system space. But like the more kind of breadth you get, the more you kind of understand different aspects of it. Like Zanzibar doesn't really talk about like distributed hash ring that you use to load balance internally. But because I had done a whole bunch of BitTorrent work, I had read a lot about distributed hash tables. So I already knew like what a lot of the cutting edge like research and how you write those and manage those. So like just kind of having additional context is helpful. But I think actually what makes the Zanzibar paper super novel is that there have been a bunch of papers in the authorization space over the years, but they're kind of just like documenting at a very high level a concept and saying like, this is what RBAC is, or this is what ABAC is, but they don't really prescribe to you what a cohesive system using those ideas looks like. And I think what was super novel about Zanzibar was that it actually kind of described the problem space and how they built one cohesive system using the principles basically described in the paper to do so. And I think that basically makes the paper kind of stand alone. Like you don't need to read a whole bunch of other things to understand it, but also made like a huge, huge gap in knowledge in kind of the authorization space. Because I gave this talk at FOSDEM and I kind of stepped through the research in the space, and then I get to basically like 2019 and then I jump back to like the 60s because Multics, the operating system, has a file system that has ABAC and like user-defined functions and all these things that were studied and like researched and created in the 2000s, but they were used in production systems in like the 60s and 70s. And it's just because like people are not kind of documenting existing systems or having like kind of cohesion around all this stuff that I think makes kind of the authorization space a little less approachable to developers. The thing I kind of always say is like authorization has been studied just as long as database systems. Every developer knows they shouldn't build their own database unless they're like, that is like their objective. If they are building an app, they're going to take a database off the shelf. If you're building an app, why are you building an authorization system yourself? You're not a security expert. It has had just as much research. Like you should be using some tooling off the shelf. And even if that tooling is not SpiceDB, I think just the industry moving towards the idea that authorization needs dedicated tools that you use and you don't re-implement yourself for every individual application will be like the massive step in progress we see in like the next decade.
Yeah, the problem is that it feels simple in the very beginning, right? Like, I will just use this Google group. I will just check what's your email, and if you have a domain this, then yeah, it's allowed. But then case by case scalability requirements, and then you end up rebuilding things. So yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do not recommend that people just starting off use SpiceDB. I've written blog posts about it. It's on our website. It'll be like, hey, if you're building an MVP, you probably don't need SpiceDB. I mean, you might if you're in like a very like interesting domain, like maybe you're in healthcare or something, but that's an outlier. The vast majority of folks building applications, just write it yourself at the beginning. You need basic roles, but acknowledge the fact that when like the customers come knocking and you have product market fit, at some point they're going to start asking you for more and more complex authorization logic, and like you're going to start deploying in enterprise environments that require multi-month long audits by security auditors to get stuff deployed there. Like you're going to want to start adopting some of these tools and move away from kind of your homegrown systems. Yeah, but not at the beginning. Figure out your product first.
That's actually a great segue. One of the kind of most difficult things for startups is, finding their first customers. And especially in a space like yours with authorization, right? As you say, it's not for MVPs what you're building. So kind of selling to other startups that are just starting out, this may be kind of out of the question. How do you find your first customers? And how did your product convince them that, this is something actually bringing value to them?
Yeah, I think just to like kind of jump back into the finding kind of your first customers and like what's it like at the beginning. We did YC in winter 21. So we are actually exposed to a good community of other startup founders. And they kind of do this thing where you get to intro yourself and meet, and you talk to a bunch of different teams there. And what we quickly learned was our product was like not for startups. Like these people are all trying to figure out what the hell they're doing. They're not thinking about how they're going to model authorization for that. They're trying to figure out how they're going to get their first customer as well. So we slowly kind of like moved up. Okay. Who actually like needs this? So we would talk to like healthcare companies, and even when at the startup phase, they would be the ones that would listen to us the most and be like, yes, I realize that I need to build like really complex like logic around the stuff, because for example, like doctors only have access to patient data when they're assigned to a particular clinic, right? Like there's a lot of additional logic there that isn't just like this email domain is this user, right? We kind of figured out there's a couple of industries by doing that, at least, like what would be a good kind of like starting place industry-wise. But then the real takeaway was that we kind of sat down and thought for a minute, like who is actually feeling the most pain from this problem? And it's not the startup that has to build the most simple model at the very beginning. It's actually these folks that have mature businesses and are like struggling to kind of wrangle all their users or all the kind of details around the data they have, like securing the actual data. Maybe they need to build a new feature and they just never accounted for basically the level of access, the granularity of the access they would need to implement that feature. So kind of through that lens, we started to target larger businesses and kind of do content marketing around that. But really, I think we got very lucky because it was kind of a like, we're looking for them and they're looking for us. kind of scenario where we were actually trying to solve, we basically started to target that exact problem. We're like, we know big companies are kind of feeling this pain because we felt this pain when we were building Quay and Tectonic. And they would basically arrive at the Zanzibar paper just like us. And then people would do this thing, which is they would search for open source Zanzibar, and then there we were. So it was kind of like we just happened to like meet the market where they were looking, and we tried to be in the places where people would naturally look when they're solving this problem. Thus, kind of, Bartek was mentioning that we kind of annotated the Zanzibar paper and put that online. Like, that's all a part of that kind of content marketing strategy to say, like, actually, like, people wanting to understand this paper, having our annotations will help them understand it, and they'll get a lot of value out of that. But then also they'll realize that, like, who are these experts telling me what's important about this paper? Oh, wait, they're the people that are actually going to, like, build the thing and solve this problem for me. So, yeah, I think largely for us, we kind of had this content marketing engine and kind of being where people were looking for the solution that helped us kind of find our first customer. And, yeah, we got all kind of outreach. Still to this day, we mostly get inbound. We still do outbound as well, and that's actually been shockingly successful because we know our audience pretty well at this point. But I think a lot of it is just being at the right place at the right time and really thinking, talking to a lot of people and figuring out actually where your product is going to fit the most. We got lucky with the cloud native ecosystem too. Like, we had a lot of connections in that space and knew how to like build software in that way. So our target companies are already kind of like adopting or had adopted cloud native software. So they built up a platform team. They probably solved authentication in the platform team. And then they were like, okay, now what about authorization? Like, for the platform team, how do I do authorization across my whole business? And really, like, there isn't anyone else kind of but us really solving that problem for the platform team. So it's kind of like a natural kind of, like, they go looking and they find us kind of thing.
And maybe a quick question, like, how fast you delivered? Like, Zanzibar paper was published. You know, how far, how many years, months have, you know, passed until you had like a sales or at least like a project visible that you are the experts? And was that important? I think, that's also the question, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, no one cared about us whatsoever until we open sourced. So I think open source is a huge top of funnel for your business. Like, it's how people learn about you. It's how people trust your product in the space too. But it was probably, so Zanzibar paper was published in 2019. We started the company in August 2020. And our first customer is like, we basically open sourced SpiceDB, basically celebrating the first year of our company. So probably August 2021 is when we open sourced it finally. And around that time, I think, I don't remember how many months after that we got our first customer, but it wasn't too long after that. We did a lot of things like you open source at v1.0 rather than starting at a less than 1.0 because like it was stable software. We had written it for like we had been using it for basically a year. And I think a lot of people like to kind of hedge, like software engineers will be like, okay, it's not super stable, so I don't really want to commit to 1.0. But actually, like, optics wise, you kind of need to do certain things like that to make people trust your software and like indicate that it actually is stable and ready to use. So we kind of came out the gate, we launched at 1.0.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I'm trying to think any other like major milestones.
No, but like we already know that, yeah, it's 2 years roughly that you have to deliver something. And that's actually not, you know, too long, especially in this space. And I think it's super fast. Sense. I think we're navigating to like, yeah, some tech questions and topics even. And I have so many in mind, but maybe you have something.
Yeah, definitely. So it's kind of related to tech. People find your project. People find people looking for authorization solutions. They find the Zanzibar paper. They look for open source Zanzibar implementations. They find your project. And what happens next? They just install it, play around with it, and this solves their problem, or they have to contact you and you have to integrate it for them. Like, Yeah. What's the whole process of somebody who needs this to them solving their problem?
Yeah. So it's super interesting. When we kind of first started the project, we called it an authorization service. And it was kind of only until I really pushed to brand it and think about it like a database that I feel like people started to really understand what that integration looks like. So today we have like a playground. So we actually take the database and we compile it to WebAssembly. We actually also compile our command line tool that you can use to like basically our like kubectl equivalent to kind of like query and kind of debug systems. We also compiled that to WebAssembly. And then that runs in a browser. So you can go to play.authz.com and then like just play around with that. Basically, you get to write a schema for the database, and we have examples that you can load, and then there's test data that you can also write to it and maintain, and then you can actually write assertions about that data, like how it evaluates, and then we can actually generate exhaustively all the possible paths through the graph, that through the schema basically that you write, so you can kind of exhaustively check like, hey, what are all the things this guy can access, or like who are all the people that can do this? And if a name pops up that you shouldn't don't expect, it's like, okay, now I know that I actually have a bug in this. And so that tool is like super useful for giving people a taste without installing anything. That tool is also super useful for people that are, like, already have the full stack going and everything, because you can actually export things out of that. And we actually will like export the schema and like all test data and assertions and things. And then you can check that into CI/CD and basically make sure that if any developer wants to change the schema or do anything like that, there's a CI/CD process that kind of assert, like runs all of your assertions and checks all these things before it ever gets deployed into production. So you can kind of get some guarantees around your permission systems kind of in a vacuum, right? And I think that's super powerful just as a tool chain, because otherwise people are just kind of ad hoc writing SQL like queries to their database, and they built their own frameworks and their own test suites for this stuff. It's all bespoke, and it's integrated deeply in your application. And now it's like kind of pulled out in a vacuum that you can kind of test. So building that tool chain helps a lot. But a lot of people just end up basically trying the open source. So they use Homebrew if they're using a Mac, for example, or if they're using Debian, we have packages for like RHEL and all the different kind of Debian flavors that they can just apt install SpiceDB, and then they can start playing with it. Same way with the playground, you can take a schema, write it to it, and then use our command line tool to like kind of start writing data to it or query that data. And we even kind of give you like nice output where we show you how internally, basically SpiceDB is a graph. So we can show you graph traversals throughout the whole thing, kind of like how you'd write an explain query in a SQL database. And we show you where time is spent on each of those things too. So you can kind of like have an understanding of the performance characteristics. But largely people get to play with that without even really touching their applications, like integrating with their applications. And then when they kind of have an idea that like, okay, this is like, I could model my domain. This is how we would store the data in it. Like this is the type of like queries we would make against it. That's when they start looking at our client libraries and the integration with their software.
So that sounds like a self-service. Like it's kind of like allowing, you know, people to be independent here. So I think the elephant in the room is like, how do you monetize? How do you actually earn money here?
Yeah, so we definitely do a lot of, there's a lot of people that walk through kind of that open source angle and run it themselves and have success. And kind of what I was saying earlier is like anyone using these authorization tools is a win in my book. Like anyone moving forward to like a safer and more secure internet is like, that's great. That is the mission that we want for our business basically. And the idea is that some portion of those folks are going to find our tool. They're going to find that to be the best fit. And then another portion of that folks will basically pay us to run it for them. So we sell basically a SaaS version of SpiceDB, which is a platform where we basically run SpiceDB for you in a completely isolated environment. So we call it dedicated. And basically, we spin up a whole separate cloud account for your use case. Spin up a whole stack, Kubernetes stack, give you a dashboard that's basically puppeting Kubernetes under the hood to deploy SpiceDB and any periphery services around that, and give you kind of monitoring and like tracing and all these kind of like extra metadata around it for you to understand the performance characteristics of how things are running. That supports multi-region deployments. So if you need to be deployed in like across the whole world, basically, we even support that. So there's kind of like the typical database playbook where a lot of databases are open source, but no one really wants to run their database. Well, we're kind of one of those. And it's actually interesting because not only like there's your typical database, which is kind of annoying to run, so everyone wants to run a SaaS version because it's stateful. But not only is that the case for SpiceDB, it's also kind of like very sensitive data. It doesn't have PII in it, right? It's normally metadata, but it is like security critical. So no one really kind of wants it intermixed with anyone else's stuff. So it's security critical. So you really want it in a like good environment, like a secure environment. But then also it's very latency sensitive. So this is something that you're going to be doing permission checks before you query your SQL database. And people think of their SQL database as like probably the lowest latency thing in their system and the place where latency is the most critical. But all this stuff is happening before you even query your database. Or if you're lucky and it's a read pattern, you can actually kind of do them in parallel, right? You could do the permissions check and read from your database, and if basically erase them. And if the permissions check comes back negative, you just throw away the results rather than returning them. But at the end of the day, like we're actually a pretty sensitive service that's like probably pretty annoying to run. So like that's great. You can run it yourself. If you struggle, like come back to us. We'll help you run it. And we do support folks on-prem as well, with kind of like support packages. And then we do build a proprietary version of SpiceDB called SpiceDB Enterprise that adds basically just features that enterprises need. So that is a little bit of sprinkling on top. But then also a lot of people end up basically paying for that too, even if they're running self-hosted, because we do an embargo, security embargo program as well. So if someone does a responsible disclosure for a vulnerability, like we're going to patch all of our customers first on the SaaS platform and then give a heads up and provide patched binaries to all of our customers before we end up making it a public release process on GitHub to the open source. It turns out that's kind of like a critical thing that most businesses need anyway. And I feel like you could probably just have a business that is purely open source and just based on the security embargo, like you could have a whole support business based around that.
That's super interesting. Actually, this is the first time I'm hearing about security embargo. But is the idea here that you don't want to immediately disclose it in the open source so that threat actors cannot act on it before your customers have been patched?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah, makes sense.
About the performance side, very naively speaking about, you know, I guess our authorization, you know, the common concept is to create certificates, you know, like OAuth2 applications and all of this delegation. So you kind of like sign them. And then on this point, when you sign them, you kind of like check the permission and you kind of like encode those permissions. So they're kind of statefully set. And, you know, you can set like a 1 hour expiry. So essentially this kind of like doesn't put a lot of load and it's not sensitive anymore that much to the whole system. Instead, sounds like you've chosen to be like sensitive. So on every request you call, so you have to kind of like be very, very fast. What is the only kind of trade-off here? The kind of like not being able to revoke this certificate for 1 hour? That's the only trade-off when you kind of design those system, or there is more to it? Why you have to be on the hot path?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I wrote a blog post kind of about this, and I focused mostly on JWTs, which like JSON Web Tokens, which are kind of like I feel like it's a technology people love to hate.
No,
a lot of people use them.
Pretty easy to use.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we use them a lot at previous companies, but yeah, I think there's a lot of useful patterns where you can use JWTs, and a lot of APIs use JWTs, but they do have trade-offs. And I think like a lot of the front-end ecosystem have kind of moved away from JWTs, and they kind of acknowledge trade-offs at least. And there's a lot of good blog posts talking about like kind of like where you can cut yourself using them. But I think that there actually haven't been a lot of blog posts talking about that for backend folks kind of writing like service to service authorization and things like that. So I did write a blog post about this, and I think like the short answer to kind of like the service to service authorization is a lot of people doing JWTs or any kind of claim based authorization, you kind of have to do all this work ahead of time, and you have to know a lot of things ahead of time. So a user logs in, and that's probably when you're going to load user information, you're going to do authentication handshake and like understand, assert they are who they say they are. And then what you're going to do is you're going to slap a couple claims onto the JWT. And the claims are saying like, they have this role in this application or whatever. There's kind of a couple problems with those claims. One is like, they often lack context and granularity. So there's often lots of information missed there, or that just can't be represented there. And then the other thing is, what if you're like a God mode user? Like, what if you have access to literally everything? Or what if you're not God mode, but actually you just have access to a lot of things, like 20,000 things? You can't really fit that in your JWT anymore. So it's not really a thing that you can actually do in a bunch of different use cases. But then on top of that, what if you have access to 20,000 things, but actually this request, it only needs three of them, but like you don't actually know what they are until you kind of jump across like three or four different microservices. So now how do you know which claims are actually important to this particular request that you want to keep inside your JWT? So there's kind of like a lack of flexibility in these systems that you kind of get by trading off having something centralized that has kind of all this data stored in it ahead of time, indexed so that you can kind of query it fast. You can actually think about the consistency model of the data as well. So we talked about revocation as well. You can actually be confident that like the data is fresh or as fresh as you need it to be when you're querying it. And you can do things ad hoc and not have to like kind of pre-plan or refactor anything. So often a lot of people kind of just build their microservices in a way such that they trust anything coming from another service rather than trusting the context of the request. So we actually did this with Quay. So Quay had a vulnerability scanning service called Claire. So when Claire would go to scan images for Quay, it basically just kind of had God mode on Quay to pull down whatever images it wanted so it could scan them and then return results, right? That's not really great. Instead, what you really want to do is have some user context that can get passed all the way through your microservice chain. And basically just the user is all you need, the unique identifier for the user. I'm working on behalf of this user. And then you want an external service that you can query and say, I'm doing this for this user. Is this user allowed to do this? Should I be doing this for this person? And then only basically when you need it are you actually making those requests. So now you don't have to pre-plan any of this stuff. You can refactor your microservices. You can change how everything works under the hood. And in a lot of ways, for SpiceDB, the magical moment that we have is kind of this day two operations moment where you basically make a change to your SpiceDB schema and you don't touch code in any of your applications. You change the schema, you apply the schema to your database, and then it's kind of backwards compatible in a way where no code changed, but all of a sudden like you got this new functionality or it's more secure or like you're able to migrate some data or something without any of your applications being updated. Because in your applications, all you're asking is, should I be able to do this thing for this user? There's no additional context. There's nothing else there. So there's no logic being applied to that. All of that is done in the centralized place. So you update it in one place and you get it everywhere. And like that moment, the first time you do that, you're like, oh my God, I don't have to go through weeks of auditing everything. I don't have to rewrite half my applications. Like I just made this one tiny, like we've had customers that are like, it was a 3-line change. I can't believe it. Like I cannot believe it. It's truly magical. Yeah.
Especially if somebody does it for you. Like if you have to build something like this from scratch, it's going to be a pain, but yeah, if you can just get it off the shelf, it's amazing.
Yeah, you convinced me. and sounds like it's this sensitivity part makes it even easier to kind of like help enterprise to do it. Like it's so hard to kind of like make a global service that is so critical and kind of work fine in a secured manner. So that's a great, yeah, that's a great business idea.
Yeah, I think not everyone needs global, right? I think one of the things that's not maybe intuitive, like if you kind of look at our product, we say it's authorization that scales, but scale is actually a bunch of different dimensions. Like a lot of people just think of it in terms of like traffic or like replicas that I have to like have more of, or even with like deploying across regions. But we kind of think of it also just in terms of like aspects like development velocity. Like, can you scale your team? Can you scale your, like the speed at which you're actually delivering features to your product? And so like a lot of folks, they don't use it in a global environment. They don't need global replication or to have like consensus across the ocean to do this stuff. They just want it in a single region because they're focused on the like feature velocity scale rather than like the geographic scale, right? So to that end, we also have versions that are kind of like not necessarily paying the cost of doing like full consensus and things like that that you would need when you're kind of crossing an ocean. So yeah, SpiceDB is really interesting because it's not a traditional database in that it has its own kind of key value storage layer to disk, but instead we have a very, very similar abstraction that is basically a tuple storage, which is what everyone would use something like LevelDB or RocksDB, except we plug other databases in there. So we basically use other databases kind of as dumb storage, but it provides us a lot of trade-offs. Like you can run this with a SaaS backend. Like you can just reuse Amazon Aurora or reuse like RDS or something like that if you want to run this easier and don't want to manage the state yourself. Or if you want something geographically scalable, we can use Spanner on Google Cloud, or CockroachDB if you're on any other cloud. So now we're getting kind of all this consensus, and there's a lot of tricks to make sure that we're getting the guarantees out of the database at the end of the day, and a lot of testing that goes into trying to like force these databases to prove that they're correct and how we're using them. But ultimately, we're kind of like a layer on top of your traditional database. And I actually recommend that like a lot of databases kind of exploring new domains do this. It's kind of commoditization of like a lot of the functionality that are existing in other databases, and lets you focus on like where you can actually innovate in the database space. So unless you need to really build out this layer, like just lean on top of other systems, become like a meta database.
How do you decide what features to work on as a team? You have, you know, the open source projects, people are posting issues, you have, you know, enterprise customers, you have your own, you know, managed solutions. How do you prioritize what needs to be done first?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a really tricky question. That's basically like the whole role of someone in product, right? The reality is having a lot of empathy for a lot of different people. You have to be able to empathize with the customers that you're working with and understand how much pressure they're under, what their deadlines are. You have to understand like what the community needs and kind of the pressure and things that they're dealing with. You have to understand your engineering team who actually has to build the stuff, the pressure and things they're dealing with, and kind of meet them all somewhere in the middle. And I feel like nobody does this perfect. It's always kind of trade-offs. And then also like, at the end of the day, you are a business. Like you need to satisfy your customers and have them be successful for you to be successful. So there definitely is give and take there. But by and large, a lot of the stuff actually kind of gets decided for you. So SpiceDB kind of has this proposal process that we follow. It's pretty loosely defined. It's not like a very strict governance there. But if an enterprise customer, for example, wants functionality or needs functionality to get into production, and it is fundamentally a change that has to happen in SpiceDB open source, well, guess what? They're going to have to start, like, we're going to have to like work with them to draft a proposal, and then we're going to post the proposal. The community is going to review it. Like eventually we'll get like criticism in, and we'll make changes to that. And then we'll like say, okay, everyone kind of agrees this is good to go. And then we'll start the implementation. Right. So like there's still kind of like some processes that are just dictated by the fact that those three parties are all working together. But yeah, I think it's always tricky, especially since like there's the things your customers need, which are like just minor improvements to make like their quality of life better. But then there's also like big projects you could work on that could dramatically change like their outlook and how they're using the product, and kind of scheduling and balancing those two is really tricky because you're kind of like working towards long-term goals while you're also keeping people satisfied and having constant improvements. So I think we have really short sprints on the engineering team, like weekly ones. I think most people probably end up doing something like 2 weeks, but we do them weekly. And that's just because I think it was more beneficial when we were earlier, like an earlier company, because you need to be able to change what you're doing like very quickly and adjust to what basically feedback you're getting. We still do weekly and still try to basically use that as a kind of reflection point to say like, okay, last week we spent a whole bunch of time working on like customer features. We should probably look at open source a little bit more, spend some more time there and kind of like evaluate how we were doing it and evaluate like our balancing between kind of all the different folks, and also like check in on deadlines for like particular customers. Like, okay, this customer is going into production at like the end of August. What things do they need? Okay, when do we realistically think we could schedule that? Is something more critical or pressing that we could like push that off maybe a little bit later for them? But yeah, it's a juggling act, basically. There's no like silver bullet. And as your company grows too, you'll completely use different tools for doing this. Like early on, like we tried using like Trello and Linear and like a whole bunch of different kind of issue tracking. Now we ultimately use GitHub because we can actually track open source alongside internal stuff. So we use GitHub projects to manage all of that, which is, it's not the best tool. Like, I'll freely admit that. It's like not really great. It doesn't, like a lot of things are just broken. It's really hard to do things in bulk. But it is all in GitHub. So you can like literally point to a PR, or we can talk about basically open source PRs internally privately and like schedule them and put them like directly into our planning. So that's a really powerful tool there because we're kind of mixed both public and private. And I really don't think there's a lot of other tools that handle both the public and private development flows. But then I also then have like all the product stuff in Notion. And we actually manage a lot of things internally at the company through Notion. And then that kind of, I manually synchronize with GitHub. We built integrations that copy things between GitHub and Notion, but it's a little bit janky. Maybe in the future, we'll like actually try to flesh out more of that stuff. But I feel like it's kind of premature optimization. They kind of tell you do things that don't scale at YC, and like me manually copying stuff between Notion and the engineering like GitHub project board. I think that works great for now, but it basically makes it very clear like what our priorities are at all times. And I have like a nice kind of like roadmap laid out that's living inside Notion. So anyone in the company is like, what's on the roadmap? What are we doing this quarter? They can open up like the roadmap page and see that. And then we have a redacted version that is like things we publicly committed to that we can share with customers. And that's really nice. It's just another view of that same roadmap. So you kind of give people the tools that they need to self-service. And then you can help them make the right decisions as well. So I'm sure engineers also feel pressure on certain things, right? They're developing stuff, and it might be actually at the end of the day, sometimes their call and not mine to pivot to a particular thing. So I want to make sure that they have the information and the tools in the places that they can find them and make the best decisions.
Awesome.
One thing we always ask, what's the piece of advice you would tell your younger self, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when you were starting company? What you wished you knew when you were starting, you know, your founding journey?
This is one of those things where I'm like, I don't know. I don't want to like butterfly effect change exactly how things played out. Like, would I actually end up in the same place? I don't know if it's super motivating, but you always look back thinking like, wow, that was an easier time. Like, you're super stressed at the beginning of the company because you're like, holy shit, I don't know what we're doing. We have no customers. We have no product. Like, we're like, what is, there's no structure. It's just chaos. And like, as the company gets like larger and larger, you get more customers and like, you start adding kind of more processes and things like you become more critical, but in different ways. And it's just different forms of stress that like you probably aren't used to as well. Like, I actually really enjoy being in the chaotic, like building nothing from, or building something from nothing. So like, that was actually less stressful for me, despite not having a job or income. I'm like, actually, this is exactly what I want. This is what makes me happy. But yeah, as the company grows, it's, I just always look back being like, I would have calls with my parents, and my parents would be like, how are you feeling? And I'm like, oh, like, I'm super stressed, but like, we're gonna hire these people, and then I'll be like way less stressed, or like, we're gonna like do XYZ, and then I'll be way less stressed. They call me like 2 months later, and I'm like, oh no, I'm still just stressed. Like, I'm probably even more stressed now. it's wild. I feel like it's all different types of stress, but I guess it's like, you're always gonna be stressed, but like, you also need to like make sure that you're kind of balancing that and making sure like you're actually spending time for you, because if you burn yourself out and just like spend all your time focused on work, and like if you're not like exercising or socializing or eating well, like eventually that catches up to you, like, and you're going to be less effective, and you're going to hurt yourself or like your loved ones in the process. So yeah, I would just recommend, like, both to myself and others, like, yeah, make sure that you have the things in your life stable that need to be stable, that give you the confidence and the focus to be able to continue to pursue what you're doing. Because things can happen, like, yeah, a lot of different things can happen in your life. And you, if you're starting a company, like, you need to be sure you're not going to worry about your mortgage like 6 months from now, for example, or like, be sure that like, if your parents get sick or something, like, you can take care of them, or like, if your dog dies, like, you can like kind of recuperate emotionally from that. Like, you just have to be in a stable place in your life and make sure that you kind of keep yourself there despite all the chaos.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, don't overwork and don't expect things to be easier. Just learn how to work with constant work, stress. Yeah, beautiful.
Awesome. Thanks, Jimmy. Final question. Where can people follow you? Where can people find out more about OZ and maybe try it out?
We're kind of in all the standard places. So my Twitter is Jimmy Zielinski, my phone name. I basically post there. Twitter is kind of the main place where I do stuff, because I still do programming despite being a product manager. GitHub is Jay Zielinski, so just the letter J. Our website is just authzed.com, authzed.com. Twitter handle is also authzed. Those are like, we also post on LinkedIn as well. But then we also have a Discord. So discord.gg/spicedb. And that's kind of for the open source community as well. We talk about SpiceDB stuff, but also distributed systems in general, and kind of like, just like anything in the authorization or distributed system space there. I think there's like maybe a couple thousand people in that Discord that you can chat with. And that's honestly, if you're like really trying to play with SpiceDB, you can go to GitHub for SpiceDB, but also, like, joining that Discord, ask questions, like, we'll answer them. There's other people in the community that answer those questions. You're probably trying to do something that someone else has already done. So it can be a huge time save just to like pick someone else's brain that's playing with this stuff. And you also shouldn't take my word for it. I'm biased. I'm the founder. I created this stuff. Go talk to some of the users and understand how they're using the product and what's making them successful and places where they're struggling, so that you get a really good understanding and have confidence in the software.
Awesome. We're going to have links to everything you mentioned and the white papers, all the blog posts we mentioned as well in the show notes. So if you're listening right now and you want to check them out, just check the show notes. Awesome. Thank you, Jimmy. It was super insightful conversation. Thank you for spending this 1 hour with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We really appreciate the feedback you give us. Feel free to follow us on social media, YouTube, or your favorite podcasting app. If you like this episode or you have improvement suggestions, feel free to message us directly on social media or use the Google form that is linked in the episode description. If you have any ideas about new episodes or guests that should join us, yeah, feel free to share it with us. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks for listening.